Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is the Nav speaking on the 12th of July, coming up to Friday, the 13th of July, 2012. And this is Nav Briefing number 17, the title being Going Forward in Correction. With our recent NAB briefings and the crew notes that I just sent out today, I'm once again at my post, and I look forward to being active and keeping you current in a lively pace, at a lively pace in the days ahead. Some of you engaged in this experiment may have noticed a palpable shift of rhythm and a palpable intensification coming through June and into July. As I pointed out several times in previous briefings, the Aunt Sophia was in a deep contemplation of previous failures of Anthropos 10 on this planet. That moment of deep introspection for the goddess, for the planetary animal mother, was indicated by the stall of the lunar apogee around 1517 Taurus at the very face of the satanic mask of Cetus. So it was during that stall, basically March, April, May, that you didn't hear from me too much. It was during that stall that I didn't actually have much to say. Like the rest of you, I was anticipating the moment when pleromic relay would come into play. That moment was, to specify it, the 16th of June. There was an apogee surge in 17 Taurus, and at that moment Jupiter attained 1 degree of Gemini, or 61 on the ecliptic. This is in close alignment to the Pleiades, and in fact Jupiter was visually positioned and is still visually positioned just a little bit below and to the east or left of the Pleiades, the inception of pleromic relay. The process of linking this planet in its bioelectrical magnetical field to the pleromic center via the spindle of the Pleiades proceeds from mid-June through July and August to a culminating moment on September 7th, 2012. At the same time that pleromic relay is coming into play, is being engaged, as it were, the planetary animal mother shifts out of her stall. She shifts out of the deep preoccupation, deep and troubled preoccupation, I would guess, with her recall of previous catastrophic failures with Anthropos 9. I'm not talking here about the 9, with Anthropos 10. I'm not talking here about the 9 episodes of planetary evolution that ended catastrophically, which she observed from the Pleroma before her plunge. I am sufficiently confident that I've made this distinction clear by now. She and the other aeons, including Thelete and Christos, engaged in a close observation of planetary experiments that arose by emergence, the principle of emergence. That is to say, this is a known principle of science, for what that's worth. The spontaneous emergence of life in planetary laboratories seeded throughout the galactic arms. I mean, this is the reality of it, folks. This is not science fiction. This is how it actually works. And you're currently now in one of those laboratorial experiments. The difference is that in this experiment, the habitat itself, the setting of the experiment, is indwelt by the divine aeonic power that conceived the experiment in the first place. And that is not true of other planetary laboratories throughout the galaxy. It may be true of some others. I wouldn't absolutely rule it out. But it is not the general rule. So the planetary experiments that Sophia was able to observe from the galactic center were previous versions of the Anthropos plasm. The germ plasm of the Anthropos underwent 9 experimental phases, which all ended catastrophically. So to get back to the plot, there was a long stall, and there are 3 more stalls ahead in correction, 3 more apogee stalls coming up. Now, very soon I'm going to give you a briefing of these stalls, these future stalls. The significance of these stalls is not something that you could understand intellectually, merely intellectually, far from it. It is something that you would have to experience empathically and through the power of your own dreaming, through your own second attention, as it correlates and interfaces with the second attention of the Aeon Sophia. We've been through a couple of these stalls so far, and I must admit that from the beginning of correction, it wasn't clear to me how to handle these stalls. They've been difficult. But having gone through a couple of them together, I am confident that we'll be in a far better position to handle them as they come up in the future of our navigation. The point right now is that the lunar apogee stood at 15 degrees Taurus on May 19th, fully locked into the stall. But then on June 16th, it advanced to 17 Taurus, just edging out. Tomorrow, July 13th, it reaches 20 Taurus. It's pulling clear of the stall. August 10th, it reaches 25 Taurus, well clear of the stall. And then it proceeds in September to 1 degree Gemini. That is where the lunar apogee arrives, around the 7th of September. And that is the epical moment, one of the spectacular epical moments in correction, close to the midway point, and pleromic relay is engaged. What you may be noticing now is the shift of momentum that's happening due to these developments with the planetary animal mother and due to this reconnection, reunion, realignment with the pleromic aeons and specifically with Thelete and Christos. There is a shift of momentum and it can only become greater and greater with no let up through the entire remaining year and a half, year and 8 months of correction. You can count on that. Now, before I proceed with an overview of current and future events in the GNE, I'd just like to ask you to consider something. You know, some of you may not be comfortable with the astronomy involved here. I know that astronomy can be a difficult subject for some people. It does involve a certain amount of math. I've been talking about astronomy for a good long time now, longer than I care to mention. And I'm quite familiar with the experience of people's eyes glazing over if they are required to conceptualize even elementary astronomical principles. But you know, there's a certain responsibility, an intellectual responsibility for anyone who wants to live with the Earth, for anyone who wants to engage the living intelligence of the Earth, to be part of her story. You need to take a little astronomy on board. And perhaps I can entice you to that, those of you who are not already enthralled and engaged in it, find it to be the greatest thrill in the world, as I know some of you do. But perhaps I can invite you and entice you and seduce you into the astronomical matrix of correction, as it were, into the practice of astronomical real sky observation and the observation of planetary cycles and lunar and telluric cycles. Perhaps I can increase your interest in that by pointing out something to you which you would be wise to consider and you would be an idiot to ignore. My role as a navigator, I'm teaching you how to observe certain things in the sky and how to track lunar, stellar, and telluric activities with charts. For instance, by following the lunar cycles, we can't actually observe the lunar apogee, but we can observe that part of the sky where it occurs, where the surge occurs, and where the lunar apogee is transiting. So, as you know, the practice or the method of the GNE involves a combination of observational and non-observational techniques. And the non-observational technique is very minor. You know, you can learn what it means that Jupiter stands at 61 degrees of the ecliptic scale, visually conjunct the Pleiades. You can learn that quite easily. And as you're learning these things, and as you're taking on board into your NLP and into your cognitive framework, allowing your mental parameters to accept this intel, I'd like you to consider this. There is no single moment, no single day in the illusion of time that is not unique. There is no single day in a year, and no single day or week in a decade in which the celestial, lunar, and terrestrial factors do not combine into a unique configuration. It is only the archontic mind and the programmation of the archontic mind, which we're all subject to, myself as much as you, that leads us to the false inference that it's all repeatable, it's all in a perpetual, there's a perpetual cycle of celestial mechanics, clockwork mechanics, going back to the Newtonian idea of a clockwork universe. And everything is clockwork, and Venus appears here and there each year predictably. We can predict the cycles and the conjunctions of Venus and Jupiter or Venus and Saturn and so forth and so on. This is all an archontic haze of cognitive oblivion. What I am inviting you to do is see what actually happens, not think about how it happens by way of a paradigm that trains your mind and runs it into a rut. I assure you that the events that you are following under my navigational guidance are absolutely and totally unique in real time and will never ever occur again in the exact way that you are learning to observe them. Let me give you an example. Venus goes retrograde. Venus has its retrograde cycles every few years. You can go and check it. You can go read about it. And it's predictable. But when do you see Venus conjunct Jupiter, then race ahead along the line of stars that defines the northern horn of the bull to the tip of that configuration, to El Nath, the tip of the northern horn, then reverse itself in El Nath, precede back to the head of the bull, conjoin again with Jupiter, with the star Aldebaran, the bullseye, in the configuration, then turn again forward and proceed along the stars that define the lower horn of the bull to Alheka or Zeta Tauri, the star that marks the tip of the lower horn. How often does anyone on this planet ever observe that? Well, I'll tell you, never. Never. Never before and never again. And the kick and the thrill of these observations I'm proposing to you is that they bring you into real time and they bring you into the imminent immediacy of eternity. And that's the only place to really live, because everything else is just mechanical. I assure you that the tango dance between Jupiter transiting through the fishes, the ram, the bull, the twins, and the lunar apogee, one of the defining components of correction, the coordination of the lunar apogee and Jupiter, is like nothing anyone has ever seen before. I'm not only showing you how to observe the cosmos, I'm showing you how to observe the imminent and immediate originality of the living celestial code. And that is a kick. That is really a kick. Because if you observe this code, if you make even the most simple and elementary attempts to connect and engage with this code, then you become encoded into the cosmic process itself. And you truly live on the cosmic scale, with your feet on the earth and your eyes to our divine mother animal. So I invite you to stay with this experiment as we now enter its most exciting phase, and the pace is picking up. And as far as I can tell, it's picking up at one hellacious rate. This would be expected if the event of pleromic relay is anything more than a mythomaniac fantasy in the mind of John Lash. Well, we'll see about that, won't we? Now, to proceed with this preview and overview, let me refer to tomorrow, July 13th, which is a Friday. And this is a day of an apogee surge, as we call it, meaning that that is a day when, at some point during the 24-hour period, the moon in its orbit around the Earth passes through that point at which it is most distant from the Earth, its apogee. And the apogee moves through the constellations. This is the indication of the recapitulations of the wisdom goddess. The apogee is a point of the dreaming attention, or second attention, by contrast to the perigee, the near point of the moon, which corresponds to the first attention. So on July 13, 2012, the apogee is in 20 degrees of Taurus, shifting off its stall point. And Jupiter, which just a month previously had attained the Pleiades, has now advanced to about 7 degree Gemini, 67 of the ecliptic, that is to say about 6 degrees beyond its exact alignment to the Pleiades. The following apogee surge will be August 10th in 25 Taurus, and then finally, as I noted, on September 7th, the apogee occurs at 1 Gemini, and the lunar apogee itself is pointed to the Pleiades. This is the completion of pleromic relay, the completion. Now, let's stop here and consider for a moment, what have been the considerations of the wisdom goddess in her process of recapitulation? Recapitulation being a practice of sorcery. If you read Carlos Castaneda, you'd be quite familiar with how that works. Sorcerers recapitulate in order to free themselves from the force of what is called in Greek myth and also in the Gnostic cosmology of the Apocryphon of John, the hymarmony, which is the entrainment of habit or repetition compulsion. You know, the common cliche, those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. It's a way of describing repetition compulsion. The factor of repetition compulsion in the animal species is a very deep matter. I've pointed out that I've struggled, as has no other Gnostic scholar, to decode and decipher the meaning of certain passages in the Apocryphon of John, or the Secret Book of John, which occurs in three versions in the Nag Hammadi codices. This passage concerns what I call adulteration. Now I said, I let slip in some previous briefing, the suggestion, hate that again, that's really a wicked meme and a narcotic term. Actually, an honest and transparent person never suggests anything. But I suggested in my own enticing manner that there was an adulteration of the human genome due to a kind of deal that Sophia cut with the Archons. Well, this is one hell of a subject. And this is the kind of thing that Calicus and Telestai and members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment sit around talking about late into the night. This is something we deeply endeavor to understand for the success of our experiment, not to mention the fate of this benighted species, Anthropos 10. Anthropos 10, let me see if I can paraphrase it for you now. This is right off the top of my head. I haven't rehearsed this and I've never said it before. It appears that the adulteration indicated in the Apocryphon of John subjects the human animal to a repetition compulsion, hymarmony, which can also be translated as the entrainment of different levels of compulsion. So the human animal operates under compulsion. Why? Because we're social animals and we create a complex social order by consent or non-consent or by unconscious and unwitting consent. And within the social order human animals create, which is different from the social order of all other animals on the planet, the members of the tribe, of the herd, become subject to compulsions directed upon them from the very social order itself. This is hymarmony, repetition compulsion. And it appears that this repetition compulsion, which I would signal also by the word conformity, social conformity, is a peculiarity of the human herd of animals. Well, you know, that may sound like an odd statement, but consider this for a minute. If you look at a tribe of caribou or a herd of caribou or a herd of elephants or a herd of lemmings, whatever, their behavior appears to be highly conformistic. All the animals behave in the same way. They have a herd instinct. They have a herd mentality, almost like a group soul, to use that old theosophic term. Well, it is true that they do. But it's not like the herd mentality of the human animal. It's much more straightforward. It doesn't actually affect the herd behavior, the compulsive and conformistic behavior of a herd of caribou does not act in a deleterious way upon the individual members of the herd. Obviously not. They have that behavior to protect the individual members. Well, this is absolutely not the case with the human herd. In fact, it's absolutely the opposite. The conformity
of human behavior, the repetition compulsion, the compulsion to follow social norms, the compulsion to do things at the same time that other people do them, and the countless other compulsions that comprise the social dynamic of the human animal can be extremely deleterious to the individual animal. You could say, again, I'm improvising, now, when Sophia cut a deal with the Archons, she didn't literally allow them to adulterate the genome. I stand by my position that the Archons cannot hack the human genome. However, in some weird way, for some bizarre reason, due to the compulsion that she herself was under at that time, our divine animal mother, Gaia Sophia, allowed the human species to come under an undue and precipitating influence of the Archons through repetition and conformity. We have an inordinate tendency toward repetition and conformity. That's the adulteration, not of the genome, but of our behavioral norms. And to the extent that behavior is rooted in a genomic inheritance, and it is to a certain degree, then it extends this adulteration, or frelatage, as it's called in French, extends into the genome. We know now, I mean, read the biology of transcendence and read the biology of belief and listen to the lecture of Bruce Lipton. What are they telling us? Bruce Lipton is one of the leading proponents of epigenesis. Now, epigenesis is the new form of behavioral genetics that completely blows classical Darwinian genetics out of the water. Okay, Darwinian genetics is a complete lie anyway. We know that. But the predators, the dogma of genetics is now blown away by the science of epigenesis. And the bedrock of the science of epigenesis was the discovery of reverse transcriptase sometime, I think, in the late 60s. The presence of this chemical, reverse transcriptase, and the operations of this chemical as studied, as discovered at that time, proves that behavior does not proceed in a determined, predetermined way, in a rigorous, predetermined way from your genome. On the contrary, the genome itself can be reprogrammed by changes in behavior. This is particularly true of the human animal, I would say, and probably not true, or certainly very less true, of other animal species. So in the detection of reverse transcriptase and in the inception of the new science of epigenesis, wow, look at what we've got here. We've got a proposition that says that your behavior, which is also largely based on your beliefs about yourself and the cosmos. So your behavior and your beliefs about your behavior, when they are changed, can change you biochemically right down to the genetic level. And in fact, it has been demonstrated that reverse transcriptase is the chemical that RNA uses to rewrite DNA. And this is just, a fact of science, for whatever facts of science are worth. Take it on board. The value of this fact of science is that it prompts us to a fantastic awakening regarding our behavior and our genetics and the relation between the two. Now, I would say that this new science of epigenesis is a tremendous breakthrough. It's a portal toward opening the way to understand the adulteration that Sophia allowed. She allowed the archons to have, in a way, an undue influence over us. She gave them an edge in their game. Why would she do such a thing? Well, I don't know. I have to talk to her about it and observe what she herself is reflecting, how she herself is reflecting on this point as she pulls out of the stall. You know, she's certainly been thinking about this because feature it this way, you know, put yourself in her shoes. Put yourself in her skin. Would you dare to do that for a minute? Well, no one on earth yet knows her reasons for committing adultery with the archons, quotes, as the passage in the Apocryphon of John is translated. Okay, no one knows. The Nav doesn't know. The Nahual doesn't know. Why she allowed human behavior to be adulterated to the advantage of the archons. This adulteration is not tantamount to access to the human genome, but it amounts to almost the same thing. Now look at today, look at transhumanism, look at the top echelons of the global psychosis. Look at the insanity of the predators with their transhumanist agenda, which goes back, of course, to Melchizedek and the Zedekim. Don't look anywhere else for it. Don't bother. Look at all that. This is excessive. This is excessive insanity, and yet it works. And the advantage of the eugenic psychosis is that it depends on an edge that Sophia herself gave to the archonic powers against Anthropos 10. I mean, get your mind around that concept. Now, this is something I couldn't have said to you 2 months ago in May, or even a month ago at the beginning of June. I was silent, and we were running silent for a while. I didn't say anything because I didn't have anything to say. Now we're all looking at this proposition together, and I invite you to look at it with sobriety and very, very close scrutiny. If I've stated this proposition correctly, you have to wonder, how is this repetition compulsion of our species going to be broken? How can the conformity of the herd, which operates in a deleterious and destructive manner against each individual member of the herd, in a syndrome of auto-destruction that does not appear in any other animal species, how can that be broken? How can that be shifted? That behavior, that syndrome, how can that be shifted? I don't know, but I can smell it coming. Speaking of smell, by the way, I'd just like to point out something. This is an observation of the Nav. You know, I'm in the same boat as you, and not just metaphorically speaking, but astronomically speaking, of course. But my observations are, you know, to a certain degree, just like yours. And so I offer mine to you as you offer yours to me, writing to the Navigator. I have noticed, and had this confirmed with one other person, that quite recently, I would say in the last 2-3 weeks, there's been a huge amplification of my sense of smell. And so I've noticed that when I'm going around my house or I'm out on the terrace, just sitting there, that I can smell things better than I could before, and that I can smell things that I couldn't smell before. It seems like my sense of smell is being amplified. You know? It's funny, it reminds me of that terrible movie called Wolf with Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer, in which it's another Hollywood version of the werewolf story. So Jack Nicholson turns into a wolf, and one of the, he doesn't actually visibly transform into a wolf. It's not the usual flagrant case of lycanthropy. Such cases are apparently known to exist. But one of the things that alerts him to the fact that he's undergoing some kind of metamorphosis is that he can suddenly smell everybody and smell everything like an animal smells. Well, this is happening to me now, and perhaps to some of you as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a similar amplification of the other senses as pleuromic relay kicks in. So getting back to this question of repetition compulsion, haimarmony, which is translated by scholars as fate, astral compulsion, fate, okay? Getting back to this subject, let me state the obvious. We always look at correction with double vision. We know that Sophia's correction is a diorthosis. That means that it is a two-part correction, a two-part solution. One part of the solution is the one you're in, the Gaian navigation experiment, planetary tantra. That is the part of the solution that is guaranteed to succeed. Commit your life to her. Practice planetary tantra, and you are in her solution, simple as pie. The second part of the solution concerns those who don't engage in her solution in the way that we're doing it right now. Well, what about them? Well, of course, we in the crew, we on the mothership, tend to speculate now and then about what's going to happen with the herd, the collective. And to what degree and how and in what manner and according to what conditions and leading to what consequences might there be correction in the collective, in the herd. So in the future, I'm going to use the syntax in the herd to refer to the collective. Now, the herd of humanity is hopelessly mired in the games of the planetary, of the psychopaths, of the interspecies predators. This is obvious. And what adds enormously to the advantage of the predators is the edge that Sophia gave to the Archons. The tendency, the overriding tendency of human beings to behave in blind conformity and to endlessly repeat the compulsions that are engendered in them by family, social, racial, religious, and linguistic programs. The defining programs of the human species, which are not found in anything like the same form in other species. Okay. Let's say that we're looking to Pam herself to remedy this situation. She's going to correct the situation. If you're on board with her, you're already in her correction. You're in her dreaming. And the extent to which she pulls us in, the extent to which she guides us through the Shakti cluster, and the manner in which every aspect of your personal life, intimate and external, will be transformed is unimaginably spectacular and wonderful, and it's happening right now. And it will never stop happening. It will never taper off, ever. It just builds and builds and builds. As you're engaged in this fantastic experiment with the supernatural, can't help but wonder how she's going to handle the herd. Now, I tell you, I've seen some things about this that turn my blood to ice. And yet at the moment that I saw them, I felt a surge of love from the earth like none that I'd ever felt before. You know, she loves me a lot. And I can feel that, and I mean me individually. But I haven't really felt her love for the Anthropos until a few days ago. I want to shift the conversation now to the perigee surges and give you an overview of current and future events. The perigee surges represent her operations in the first attention and through her own first attention. And the perigee surges, as you know, are designated by the syntax divine alchemy. It would be reasonable to expect, I think, that if divine Sophia pulls off a shift in the behavior of the herd and breaks humanity out of harmony collectively, wow, if she does that, she would do it in a way that we can chart by following the perigee surges, okay? The only time I ever felt her love for humanity as a whole, the first time I ever really felt it, honestly, I mean this, was, you know, not too long ago. It was right here in front of me. July 1st, 2012, perigee in 12 degrees of Sagittarius in Antares in the heart of the scorpion. I've talked a little about that and about my conversation with Spider Woman. Yes, I had a conversation with Spider Woman. And Spider Woman really laid it out for me regarding her intentions for the collective. And I'm still integrating that. I'm folding it and blending it into my mental syntax with the intention of speaking at length about it with great care in the not too distant future. But the one enduring impression of that 6 hours that I underwent in a twilight sleep, which is rare for me because I don't process things in the traditional shamanic form of the horizontal, eyes closed, twilight sleep. That's not my telestic preference. But during that state, I was deeply permeated with a feeling of her love for humanity and with an assurance, crazy as it may seem, that her intention to eliminate a large part of Anthropos 10 was nothing to do with cruelty of nature. It has nothing to do with the revenge of Gaia. It has nothing to do with divine punishment for our ignorance and devastation of her body. She doesn't have a punitive bone in her body. She doesn't, the idea of punishment is completely out of her realm. But there are acts of love at the cosmic level that we are a long way from understanding. And just as, you know, you might have to put down a wounded animal, well, there you go, folks. Now, there's a very beautiful novel for those of you who still read novels. It's called Lilith, L-I-L-I-T-H, by a writer named J.R. Salamanca. It's an extremely beautiful novel, one of the most beautiful I've read in my entire life. And I used to be somewhat of a reader of novels until about 20 years ago. I read it in 17 and never forgot it. It's a story about a young man who falls in love with this girl, Lilith Arthur, who is an inmate in an insane asylum where he works. This is a really, really beautiful story, also linked in with the concept of amour courtois and romantic love and with the whole Arthurian tradition of witches and fairies. It's really beautiful. But there's a moving scene in the beginning of the novel where a young man has to kill a horse that he loves. Putting down an animal that you love, it's an act of love. It's certainly not beyond the divine Sophia to put down a good part of the human herd. You can buy the hype of the predators, you can buy the hype of the globalist psychopaths and eugenicists like Bill Gates. It's an easy shot, it's a cheap shot to point to these people because they are now making their intentions toward humanity so flagrantly obvious. But you know, they're in control, perfect control of everything but themselves, you know. Bill Gates, who is an arch predator, or maybe he's just a puppet, but he has the behavior of an arch predator, is in perfect control of everything but himself. And the illusion of control is part of the predator illness. It's key to the interspecies dementia. So let's be very careful. I advise you, as we consider this gruesome subject, to do a double take and look twice. Consider what part of the destruction of our species on this planet is actually due to the democidal and eugenic agenda of the predators, and what part of it is coming from her. And I think that that distinction is due to become vividly obvious in the next few months. So, in conclusion, let's look at the perigee surges, the pattern of the perigee surges, bearing in mind that we are looking at them with the intention to understand how the divine Sophia would correct the situation produced by her giving an edge to the archons in this mysterious act of adulteration. To put it in plain English, we're going to look at the perigee surges to consider those moments in correction that might indicate a shift of the herd mentality and the herd behavior away from conformity, blind obedience to norms and memes, and away from the repetition compulsions that are inflicted on every single member of the herd due to the particular way that social reality is constructed. And that is not anything like the way it's constructed among wolves and geese and monarch butterflies and walruses and whales, okay? She put us on a planet with an immense menagerie of other animal creatures so that we could learn from them the morality of an animal sentience and at the same time seeing how we are like them, seeing equally so how we are not like them. If we cannot learn morality, a decent and humane way to behave, and a way to survive together on this planet, from observing the animal kingdoms around us, we can't learn it at all. Period. There are big, big lessons coming up. Big insights, massive insights in this perspective. I can smell them. Right around the corner. And while you're anticipating those, see if you can hold in your mind this sequence of the perigee surges. The perigee surges have been advancing out of the Virgin and through the scales, as we know, and eventually into the scorpion. But I sent out a master scheme of these paradisi surges some time back. You may have that model. You may want to look at it. We recognize that the timing, that the behavior of the perigee and the timing of these surges in this central moment of correction is extremely erratic and unpredictable. So, let's go back to, say, May 6th, 2012. There was a perigee surge in 16 Scorpio, and at that time, that would have placed it in the right pan of the scales. Remember, the right pan of the scales contains the commodities or things to be weighed, be it grain, be it human services, be it food to eat, be it water. Commodities and resources. Whereas the left pan of the scale contains the measures, the criteria for distribution of those resources by social agreement. That would be currencies and so forth. Currencies, left pan, commodities, right pan. This is one way to work with the imaginative image of the scales, not the only one. But it's amazing that, as I pointed out to you, in that very week of May, the head of J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon, came out and admitted that there was a $2 billion problem with a deal they'd made. It's obviously a crooked and fraudulent deal, but a lot of people in the world aren't ready to accept that fact yet. But in his criminal dealings on the global scale and the manipulation of markets and the destruction of the real economies, they blew it. And they lost 2 million, and he said it could be more, and it's now up to 9, and probably will go to 16 billion, because this is the way it goes with these people. And that announcement came time to the perigee surge. We would think, but that's an announcement about currencies, isn't it? Because currencies and high-frequency trading and derivatives and credit default swaps and all these fraudulent financial instruments belong to the left pan. But as a matter of fact, that announcement came from the commodities desk in London, which is headed by a certain individual. So, it looks like these, if you want to read in the reflections in the collective world of these surges, we have some really concrete results here. Now let's advance to the next month, when you had a perigee surge in 30 degrees of Scorpio, 3rd of June. Oh, well, remember, that's in the left pan, 30 degrees of Scorpio, very close to the point where the claw of the scorpion jars the pan. We're looking at major action here in the disruption and imbalancing of high-frequency trading with computers. More than 70% of trading on the world stock markets is done between computers alone, totally by archonic devices communicating with each other. And in this phony, fraudulent, and criminal archonic system float the various currencies of the world. What happened around the beginning of June was that the currency attached, tagged, or pegged to gold and silver began to disequilibrate violently, and the price of gold and silver began to drop and continues to do so. So there are massive currency wars going on, which are indicated by these perigee surges. Now let's come ahead to the next one, which would be on the 29th of July. 29th of July. Very interesting. At this point, the lunar perigee has moved ahead and transited from the borderline between the scales and the scorpion right down into the scorpion. And 17 degrees of Sagittarius, where it hits at the end of this month, is very close to the alignment of the star Eta Scorpionis. Eta Scorpionis is the bright star that marks the lower torso of the scorpion. You want to look at the scorpion's body as consisting of three parts. The upper part with its claws, and then the star
anteres, which is in the heart, which is in the upper part, just as your heart is in the upper part of your body. The middle torso, or trunk of the scorpion, identified by Eta Scorpionis. And then the sting. So there's a hit in the trunk of the scorpion at the end of this month. But then in August 23rd, the perigee jumps back into the scales, and there is one single and unique hit of the perigee in the center of fulcrum of the scales. That occurs on August 23rd. Then there's a really unique event in September. Once again, due to the extremely erratic back and forth behavior, the extremely erratic fluctuations of the lunar perigee, on September 19th, 2012, there's actually one more hit in the Virgin. It actually jumps all the way back entirely through the scales, and it hits at 8 degrees of Scorpio. So, in the overview of this present briefing, we anticipate a really unique moment in the operations of divine alchemy. That is the last moment in correction when there is a hit in the Virgin. Following that event of September 19th comes the perigee surge, October 17th, 16 Scorpio, right pan of the scales. November 14th, 29 Scorpio, left pan of the scales. And finally, December 12th, 2012, 10 days before the winter solstice and the much discussed expiration of the Mayan calendar, there is a perigee surge in 70 degrees of Sagittarius in the trunk of the scorpion. In all, there are three exact hits at that point in the trunk of the scorpion, one of them being at the end of July, coming up, the second one in December, and then the third one in the early part of 2013. And the operative syntax for that is can be found in this current joke. Well, why do you have that silly grin on your face? You look like the cat that ate the canary. Oh, no, I ate a scorpion. So, Eta Scorpionis is the target of three perigee surges in correction. Now, in coming to my concluding remarks on this remarkable succession of events of divine alchemy, I just want to point out that this event on September 19th is a real wow moment. It's one of the big wow moments of correction, I would say. You know, 8 degrees of Scorpio came to my attention in my practice of astrology a good many years ago when I initially realized that the traditional tropical signs used by astrologers, Aries, Taurus, and Gemini, had no relation to the starry background. I went to the library on Cahuenga in Hollywood, went to the public library and looked in the astronomy books to find out what the real stars looked like out there. And so I gradually built up Starbase and the real sky constellations. And something that caught my attention from an early time in my researches was the degree 8 degrees of Scorpio. This corresponds to the last faint star that defines the veil in which the body of the Virgin is wrapped. The Virgin is a massive constellation of a woman kneeling. And the veil or shawl or scarf in which she is wrapped has many beautiful and sumptuous folds. These are the triple veils of Isis, or the undulant folds of Gaia's undies.
And as they used to call them. And the limit of these folds, which is the actual limit of the composite of the constellation of the Virgin, is located at 8 degrees of Scorpio, where, quite close to the ecliptic, there is a faint star called Cambalia. This star, for some reason or other, is known as the Alchemist Star. No one really knows why, but it's a tradition deriving from the Middle Ages. Now, I took particular notice of the Alchemist Star for various reasons over the many decades that I have been engaged in astronomy and astrology. And one factor that brought this point closely to my attention is due to the components of my own natal chart. Now, you know, crew members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment would do well to take a certain interest, of course, in their own natal charts. And somewhere along the way, we can make something of this, perhaps. I can't myself provide point-by-point consultations, but and I can't even respond in certain cases to some simple questions of an astrological nature. But those of you who are inclined to this, and I know some of you are, some of you have read Quest for the Zodiac, would like to know that when you calculate the position of the apogee and perigee of the moon at the time of a person's birth, you identify what I would call the two strokes of genius. Now, according to the designs and purposes of the divine Sophia, the whole Anthropos 10 species is a genius. We are a genius, a species. We are prodigiously endowed with faculties and capacities and skills that are not found in any other animal species. Isn't that obvious? Well, of course, the Gnostics knew very well that it is the very excess of our endowment, the excellence and exceptionality of our endowment that makes us subject to certain errors which have far-reaching consequences. The very richness and exceptionality of human intelligence makes us prone to greater errors than any other animal. And so this is a situation that we need to deal with. It can be helpful and enlightening to look at your own natal chart and see where the apogee and perigee of the moon were located at the time you were born. Because what it shows is that in your endowment, in your share of the endowment of the Anthropos, there are two points of genius. I call them the strokes of genius. There are two places in your intelligence and sensibility where the genius of humanity itself shines forth in spectacular expression. So, back in the 70s, when I was talking to scientists at JPL and trying to work out how to calculate apogee and perigee, which was no easy matter at that time, I did manage to work out those positions in my chart. So, just for the sake of illustration, I'll tell you what they are. When I was born, the lunar apogee, which is the stroke of genius expressed through the powers of my second attention, was positioned at 8 degrees Scorpio, exactly at Cambalia, the alchemist star. So the way you would translate that for myself or anyone else who has this, and this would happen every 8 and 8.5 years or so as the apogee passes that point, the way you would translate that would say that this individual, in their power, if they were to realize the full power of their second attention, full power of conscious dreaming, that would come to expression in divine alchemy and in the understanding and teaching of divine alchemy. That's a stroke of genius. On the other hand, when you look at the position of the lunar perigee in my chart, December 3rd, 1945. You find that it's in about 28 degrees of Taurus. It's moving right up into alignment with the Pleiades. And so you would say for any individual who has this configuration, if this individual were to realize his or her potential through the divine endowment of Anthropos 10, that the supreme expression of the first attention of the logical cognitive ability of this person would be manifest in the Pleiades. So, that's just the facts, and you can make of it what you will. But I assure you that what is true for me is also true for everyone else who undertakes the adventure of realizing human potential, of realizing the divine potential of humanity as the Telestai taught it to us in the past. I certainly look forward to the moment of the perigee hit in 8 degrees of Scorpio. And I would say that the significance of that moment is not something that resonates to me particularly personally, just because I have the apogee at that point. Significance of that moment is there for everyone. It's a resonance accessible to everyone. We can anticipate that at that moment, with pleromic relay having been established and completed 2 weeks earlier, that the divine Sophia is completely prepared to perform the supreme act of divine alchemy upon Anthropos 10. And what that is, what that might be, what that shall be, I cannot say. It is something to be anticipated and realized in real time as it happens. I'm sure some of you have intuitions, very strong, clear intuitions of what that might be, that supreme act of divine alchemy signaled by Kambalia, the alchemist star, the very star that hovers on the hem of the garment of Isis Sophia in the starry constellations. So, Mimetes, take heart, take heart. The best is yet to come. And the best, when it does come, for life on this planet, comes on her terms and according to her designs and no other way. So live on her terms. Know that you don't have a life of your own and be grateful for it. And live according to her designs. And in that way, have the faith of the goddess, reflecting the faith that she holds in us. The faith that you are here to live and give the best that is in you. And when all is said and done, isn't that the only thing you really want to do?